did not learn or learned the wrong thing in your linear algebra class will be made manifest to you and will be turned to pain as you attempt to answer some of these questions. It's not exactly a secret, but at least the first question is just really rephrasing something that I actually already covered in lecture maybe twice. So when you work through it, if it feels easy for that reason, it's supposed to be. If in the end you don't see why that's true, you may not have answered it correctly, or you still don't really understand it. And the goal of what we do is to really understand what we're doing here. I'm teaching you the foundations of computational geometry. I'm not teaching you hacks. I'm teaching the real mathematical basis for the algorithms that we do, and with an emphasis on generality. And so that often makes things harder. It often separates things from maybe your immediate motivation, especially if you're thinking about practical applications. If you have a specific application in mind, it's enough to have something that sort of works. And maybe you don't need to know what's true in general. But that's not what this class is about. This class, we're really going to do the foundations, and we're going to do them thoroughly. So that first homework is partly an evaluation to see to what extent you really have at least the mathematical background to do this, and to give you an opportunity and some hints in where to look to actually develop that background now. It's never too late. Linear algebra is, I used to say, when I was an undergraduate, I'd say that your math classes, I wasn't a math major, but my math classes were maybe they were vegetables. But you have to eat your vegetables. You have to keep learning your math. And there's no excuse. If you miss something, to just try to get by without it, because you're missing some vital vitamins and minerals and whatever you need from vegetables. So you need it. You need the math. Is everyone okay with the homework? I know there was people who came to my office hours.
The first question: is it okay to prove it using a picture?
You can add a picture. I think the best proofs are, it's our modern bias, but the best proofs are going to be algebraic.
Okay.
Right? You're going to write the algebra. This is the equation of the line through the points.
Yeah.
This is the linear independence.
Okay.
We can draw a picture, but a picture is not so general.
Okay.
It may give an instance of the correctness. See, a picture is okay if the proof is of the form show there exists the following.
Okay.
You say, it exists, here's one. I drew a picture of it.
Okay.
But if it's for all, it depends on the quantifier, right? In the theorem you're trying to prove. If it's an existential quantifier, the picture's probably pretty good, right? Because you just show, here's a specific example where it's true.
Okay.
If you're trying to prove something universal, then pictures.
Okay.
May be helpful for intuition, but not for correctness.
Professor, when you say the question, give some reasons that the algorithm is right. Do I have to do a looping diagram, this kind of thing, or just algorithm?
Yeah. So that's how I hedge my expectations about proofs of correctness. That's the best way to do it, to be complete. But I don't want to read novels. Anyone who's planning on writing 100 pages of text, of proof, in the hopes that I will say, well, somewhere in there is a correct proof. I may, if I don't get to the end, if I start, I don't know, some kind of Hulk rage, anger and frustration reading, I will stop reading. So, I wrote it like that in the hopes that people would get just a short, informal reason to show that they understand. In that case, maybe a full proof. Any other questions at home? I hate starting class, so I haven't finished my coffee yet. I just feel like getting colder. I hate cold coffee. All right. So we talked last time about something called a linear straight line graph, where we gave all the definitions. We started from the very basics. We talked about what a graph was, how you draw a graph, or this deep embedded graph, by the vertices, by the edges, just arcs. What were the conditions on the drawing, that it be a proper drawing, namely the non-intersection of edges. Does anyone else hear that weird echo? It's like a, when I talk from over here,
yeah,
there's like this metallic echo.
Yeah,
it's really frustrating. Okay. If I'm standing over here and I'm lecturing and I start to like cross my eyes and it looks like I'm having a stroke, it's just because I'm distracted by the echo, I promise. All right. So, linear straight line graphs. Wonderful topic, right? Merging our ideas of combinatorics to topology and then to geometry. The graph is the combinatorics. The drawing is the topology, and the straightness is the geometry. All right, so today the goal is data structures for PSLG data structures. Now, okay. Like I said, I have this bias towards doing things in maximum generality. And so one of the things that happened when developing this lecture is that, well, there are a lot of data structures to store planar straight line graphs. Is there a question? Someone? Okay, there's a lot of data structures, and I want to do all of them at the same time. And this is possible as long as you go do it in enough generality. But I won't torture you just yet. So instead, we'll build it up. We'll build up a specific one. And then maybe not this time, but maybe next time we'll see a general framework for understanding pretty much every kind of PSLG data structure that people came up with. Like if you were to look in the literature, Wikipedia, you'd find, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 really popular data structures. They all do the same thing. They all seem kind of similar. And the presentation today will be to try to build up a particular one with an eye towards showing what that general structure is, which unifies all these data structures. So let's talk about what we want from our PSLG data structures. Obviously, we want to represent the graph, but we want to represent the not just the graph structure, but the face structure that we see. So the faces, after we get to the drawing, the faces are the connected pieces of the plane minus the edges. And the types of operations we want are called incidence operations. Okay. So incidence, remember we talked about this, I believe, with the simple in Euclidean geometry. Incidence is another word, usually for intersection, but often it's for we're going to use it to mean when we have an intersection of some object with another object, say, one dimension lower. So here we want to know, for instance, given a vertex, find the adjacent, actually, you've probably seen this, incident edges. In graph theory, graph algorithms, you sometimes see this distinction between incidence and adjacency, whereas two vertices may be adjacent if they have an edge between them, but you only have a vertex incident to an edge, whereas the incident edges to this vertex are the ones that actually come out of that vertex. So we're applying these, but now since we don't only just want the combinatorial information, we want the geometric information. Maybe we want to be able to list them in some counterclockwise order. Okay, so this actually is giving some topological information about a particular drawing. Whereas this ordering, you don't have an ordering until you actually draw the graph. It may be that a particular graph is somewhat constrained in the types, in the orders that may appear, but you don't know the order until you have a drawing. And we do want to represent a specific drawing, in fact, a specific straight line drawing of the graph. So this is the vertex incidence operation, there's just one. For an edge, there's two different incidence operations. You can guess what they are. What do you think the first one is? Yeah, find faces incident to the edge. Okay, in the plane we don't have so much of ordering. There's not going to be a cyclic ordering. There's going to be at most two of them. Maybe we'll say there's always two. They might be the same. The other operation we have is to find the endpoints. Okay, this instance operation too is actually, this is just from the graph structure, right? If you just had the graph and just knew vertices and edges and who's connected to whom, you would be able to answer questions like this. You'd be able to do this one minus the ordering. There's no such thing as faces until you have a drawing. And for now, we're going to suppose that we even store a separate data structure for the faces. And so given a face, we'll want to find the incident edges. And here, I'm going to write it like this. I'm going to say in counterclockwise order again. There's going to be, this is not going to always mean what you think it means. Because of it. The one outer face, we'll probably see that one in clockwise order. Right. So the if this is the full set of operations we want to support, then if we don't do any premature optimization, we'll say that we're going to store something like the vertices, the edges, and the faces, and then we'll try to implement these incidence operations by storing other information attached to the vertices, the edges, and the faces. We'll talk about what that kind of information should be. Before we do that, though, let's do it in 1D. This is something I recommend always, always, always doing when solving a geometric problem, is ask what the 1D version of the problem is. You can gain a lot of insight from trying to take a two-dimensional problem and solve it in 1D. Usually, sometimes the problem is too easy in 1D, but in this case, I think it's just right. So what is a drawing of a graph on the line? Well, there aren't too many graphs that you can draw on the line. Does anyone know a graph you can draw on the line?
The line,
we call it the path. Yeah, path is good. In fact, any union of disjoint paths, you can do. So let's just say that the graph is the path. And so if we're going to draw in the plane, all we're doing is putting the vertices in the order of the path. I guess in theory, we could also put it in the reverse order. So for a particular path, I claim, you have to check this, that there's only two combinatorially, there's only two distinct kinds of embeddings. There are obviously different embeddings. If I change where specifically I draw this vertex, I can move it here or here, but the ordering won't change. So I've only got two different orderings. If I want to support incidence operations, one kind of maybe overkill idea, but one you may have seen because it's implemented for just graphs, is to store the edge vertex incidence matrix. And this is actually another, also, a, wait, wait, well, sparse version of this is also quite popular for just representing graphs. So where you take different, we won't do the graphs. If you have n vertices and m edges, you can just have an n by m matrix, and you add some entries here, which correspond to the incidences. So for a particular edge, if it contains a particular vertex, let me draw you a picture. This is u and v. Here's u, say, and v, and I call this edge e. In this column, I have just the two ones, and I'll say everything else is zero. So one advantage of this kind of approach is that it doesn't really limit you to planar graphs. You can represent any kind of graph in this, with this structure. The size is going to be what order m, and the operations. If we want to do, for instance, the incidence operations on the path, there's only two because we don't have faces, right? So we lose this operation and this one, and all we're left with is given an edge, find the endpoints, and given a vertex, find the incident edges. So there's only those two operations. Well, what does it look like? The first one, given a vertex, finding its incident edges, just looking through here and finding the ones.
Another question.
Yeah.
So what if you have another vertex W, in that case it's going to be a different edge. It's not possible for that column E to have three ones, right? It's not possible.
In this case, in the 1D case, that's true. It's not possible.
It's not possible.
The reason I start with this one is that even though we're really only trying to solve the 1D case, it is something you might try for a more general graph. So it's a attempt you might make that is at least clearly possible to generalize this to answer these two incidence questions, to perform these two incidence operations, even on any open planar graph. It's not a good solution. You can just check immediately that the operations will take order n and order m time. Right, order n time to check the incidence for an edge, or m time to check the incidence for a vertex. Kind of boring. And also, even if we weren't limiting ourselves to graphs that could be embedded in the line, it's not a good solution because we know from Euler's formula that the total number of edges should be linear in the number of vertices. And so this looks quadratic, right? If the graph is connected, then you're looking at quadratic size data structure when you really should be able to do this with a linear size data structure. At least that's what we know from Euler's formula. You could try to just sparsify this by not representing all the zeros and turn these into linked lists and all kinds of other optimization, but it's actually not going to get us to the right solution, so we're not going to push this idea. So okay, just another idea that's more specifically one-dimensional. Like, if you know that all you can embed are things in 1D, then you might as well just store it as a list, right? This path graph already has a structure that looks like a linked list, which is a data structure we all know and love. Let's just represent it as a linked list. Well, it gets you part of the way there. Let's say this is the graph. Well, it's not really, the instance operations aren't asking me to connect this one to this one, but rather this vertex, I should be able to get to this edge. And from this edge, I should get to this vertex. And this looks like my linked list, except it's only half of what I need, because I also need to be able to go from this edge back to this vertex, right? And from this vertex, I need to get to not only this edge, but also this one. And so what you actually see here is another data structure you know and love. This should be, what's this called? I'm going to draw it like this.
Doubly
linked list, yes. Let's try the doubly linked list. Now, we're going to add one little optimization to get to a more general data structure, and that is we're going to store only half of this information. And the way we'll do that is we'll have an object for each edge. We're going to have two half edges, one that goes this way and the other that goes this way. And now, usually we would have to store the vertices and the edge separately, but now this half edge has a vertex called its origin, and so we implicitly know for this half edge, it also has a vertex associated with it. So each single edge gets turned into two of these directed edges, which I'm going to call half edges. All right, that's a doubly linked list now, and let's just make sure that we can perform these operations. So if I have a vertex, what I would need is I would need at least one half edge that has an origin at that vertex. In this case, that's always the case, right? Only one half edge has an origin at each vertex, except maybe this one. That's not true. Right, it could have more than one half edges associated with it, but we just pick one. And as long as we can go from the half edge on one side of an edge to the half edge on the other side, I can get to the other vertex. Because what I'll do is I'll start at this vertex V. I get this half edge here is the half edge with origin at V. And now I just go across to the corresponding half edge and take the origin of that half edge. And that gives me the adjacent vertex. Or I just look at the edge E and I take the edge corresponding to E, and that gives me the incident edge. This is not an interesting case because I don't have another vertex out here. Let me just do the interesting case, which is V. If I want to report the two edges incident to V, what I would do is I'd look at some, let's call this the edge of V, because I'm going to store for each vertex one of the half edges that comes out. So there's an edge associated with this half edge. I go across to the opposite direction, and then I follow it. I follow the arrow, and I get a new edge here. So I get both edges. Now, both E1 and E2. That's maybe a little convoluted. In order to get this right, we're going to have to list more specifically how these half edges can interact and what are the operations on them. So I don't want to do it in 1D because this actually is the data structure we're going to use in general dimension. And what we'll find is that these half edges can also store face information. So here's the whole list. We're going to store V, E, and F. But now what we're going to store in this E is this is the half edges. Now, all of the information is really in the half edges. Because we set up the queries that we want to ask sometimes about specific things about specific vertices or specific faces, we have to have data structures for them. But all of the information about what's connected to what and how is all going to be in the half edges. All right, what do? So for each vertex, we're going to store one half edge E such that V is the origin of E, so that's the starting point. And if it exists, and maybe we have to store an empty set here, because it could be an isolated vertex. For each face, going to store one half edge e such that that face is the, I'm going to just define this right here, it's the face of e. So in a planar graph, and in fact you can see it here, but I'll draw it on another graph. If this is my planar straight line graph, and I have these half edges, which I like to draw like this, have these half edges, all in here. For a particular face, if this is F, I'm going to pick just one of the half edges that goes around that face. And that'll just be the, and for a particular half edge, I guess maybe this is the more interesting case, for a particular half edge, it's on one side of the edge or the other. So there's two different faces, one on each side. They might be the same face, if this is not a closed cycle. But and then for each one of these half edges, it should know what face is on each side. So it'll store a link or a pointer to the particular face on that side. And now, in the reverse direction, you just need to pick one. The point is that for a face, I'd like to be able to start traversing the boundary. It doesn't matter where we start, we just have to start somewhere. And there's a caveat in this case, which doesn't show up over here, is that you might need to have more than one of these. So it could be one for each, here it says a boundary component. Okay, and that's just because sometimes we're going to have faces with holes cut in them. And so if I, this is technically a list. We're gonna address how you do this, but then for almost everything we do, we're going to assume it doesn't happen. It's just a technicality that you can handle here, so it's technically a list. So I put one here. It's really a list.
Excuse me, sorry. Why half edges? I didn't understand that concept.
Oh, because each edge turns into two half edges.
Okay.
So we call them a half edge because it's only together, maybe they form the whole edge.
Okay.
One way to think of this too is if you think of this, I replace the black with the blue, and the blue is a directed graph. And if I write the adjacency matrix of a directed graph, of an undirected graph, it'll be a symmetric matrix.
Okay.
And if I want to interpret it as a directed graph, I just treat each undirected edge as a directed edge in each direction.
Okay.
I'm calling those half edges.
Okay.
It's actually just the name of the literature. You'll find some other names for these.
Okay.
Does it matter what half edge that we chose?
No. For now, we just want to. This is just to make sure that we have enough connections in the data structure so that we can answer these queries.
Mm-hmm. It's just a plus one, minus one stuff instead of just a plus one in case of one edge. Right? It's just in the adjacency matrix. When you do not have half edge, Aij and Aji both are one.
Yeah.
And is it just a change like in case of half edges, Aij is plus one, then Aji is minus one?
So we're not going to do that now. Like you can do that where you try to do some kind of orientation. We're not actually going to store this as an adjacency matrix.
Okay.
Right? Because the adjacency matrix only tells us the graph information. And we want to also have access to this face information. And so I find the most useful intuitive metaphor is that you're really walking around on the graph. The graph is drawn around, you're walking around, and you have some direction you're going. So, and what you're really thinking about, if you want to say, talk about a particular face, you walk sort of on the side of an edge. And there's a face that you're walking on. And now you can cross over to the other side of the edge, and then you're on a different half edge. let me write out the last condition here, what we store on the half edges, and then I'll be able to write down the operations. So for each E in big E here, which is now a set of half edges, we store the following things, some of which I've already listed here. We have something called an origin, something called a face, and it's also going to store three half edges. I think it was implicit in my description over here, but we're going to call them the twin, the previous, and the next. Each of these are the half edges, and here's what they mean. Give an example like this. If I have this half edge right here on E, then the twin of E is the one on the other side. This one is the twin of E. The next of E is this one, because it kind of follows in the direction that E is pointing. It follows around the face. It's the next one we see, and the previous. So now you can actually get to. I can label the rest of these things here. I guess this is face of E, and this is origin. So these are all the information that we're going to store with each half edge. And maybe I think this is a little bit tricky at first, so you get the right perspective here. These half edges are not the links in the data structure. Like, these aren't pointers. These are the pointers. The half edges are the objects we're storing, and the connections between these half edges are determined by twin, the previous, and the next. I know that it's common to write out data structures and draw the objects, and the arrows between the objects are pointers. It's kind of the object-oriented view of the world. But since it happens to be that the objects we're trying to represent are themselves graphs, there's some overlap in the kind of pictures we're drawing here. Don't get confused by that.
So twin, previous, and next, these are the three pointers?
Yeah.
And those are fields.
So if you were to do it in 1D, right, a doubly linked list, you would just have something like the next and the previous. And now we have this other thing, which is the twin, which changes our direction. And you could think about this even in the 1D case as adding a little bit of geometry and interpreting now previous and next as left and right. With these operations, though, you can really now navigate around. So if I'm sitting at a particular half edge, these half edges really are the handles into the data structure. Like when I want to reach into the data structure, what I really want to grab is a half edge. Because from the half edge, I can get a vertex, I can get a face, or if I need to get to another edge, if I want to start walking around the edges in the graph, I can do that just by following next, previous, and next. Just like a simple example, if I want to get over to here, this is what previous of twin.
So are faces always going to be found on a particular side of the half edge? Like here you go.
Yeah, so now this is the data structure, and we can kind of enforce certain conventions to try to make things true. I guess we will use the convention that when possible we'd like the bounded faces to be following the next arrows. Should give us the edges in, say, counterclockwise if we're. Now, what does counterclockwise mean for non-convex things? Well, it's a kind of, you might call, left-hand rule, is that if you were physically walking along this edge, the face, you want the face of that half edge to be the thing on your left hand side. Right, so walking along. As you walk along, the face of the half edge you're on should be on your left. So this is not just face of E, this is also, right, this is also face next to E.
Yeah, and for the outer face, because we have this degree one difference, so each of those half edges, the face will be the same face.
Yes.
Still two separate half edges pointing at the face.
Right, so it seems to be a kind of degeneracy, except that it doesn't break any rules. Right? As a data structure, like nothing is broken here. One funny thing does happen, and that we'll see that right now, because we're going to try to implement some of these operations using this structure, and you see that this does, well, it's a little bit strange. So how do you do it? Yeah, question.
Why keeping the origin in the last case is necessary? Because the only thing that determines the next and previous is face. Without face, keeping the face is mandatory, but the origin of B.
So you can actually get rid of either one or the other. The reason I kept around the origin is so that we could answer these queries, right? Like if I don't have a way to go from half edges or faces to vertices, I can't answer this question. I can't even find the endpoints of the hash. Mm-hmm. Which was supposed to be the really easy question, right? But also, it's natural to have, we at least have to store the vertices if they have coordinates associated with them. So maybe one optimization that is kind of happening here is that because we're only storing one vertex per half edge. That goes along with being only a half edge. But I think you need the vertices. You can get rid of the faces if you want. But you can't answer these questions, but you don't really need the faces. In fact, once you have all the half edges and this stuff, the information about the vertices and the faces is all implicit. It's all technically there. You can ask what's the difference between having a pointer to the object, which is the face, or having a description of all its edges. If I can just tell you all the edges on that face, that should be, for many applications, that's enough of a description of the face. I've indicated to you what that face is just by telling you what the edges are. I don't need maybe a separate object for it.
But if we eliminate the face, I think the query time will be increased.
I guess maybe it depends on what, again, we have to redefine what the correct output of a query is. It might double on average. All right, so these are going to be our conventions. Let's write down, I guess the easier one, let's do first, is given a face, list all the edges of the contour of the room. Edges. How do you do it? What's the first step? And we have a half edge.
Yeah. And after that, we find next edge.
Yeah, so first I have to initialize this, so I'll start with, this is what I call the half edge of the face. So I get one half edge associated with the face, and now you said, well, I take the next one, right? So, what will I do? I guess I'll do something like, let's say h prime equals um, well, loop, I guess it's true that I can output H. Let's have a list. Let's say I put the output on some list, and I'll push H onto the list. And now I'm going to say H equals H dot next. And yet I'll want to push H onto the list again. And obviously I want to rewrite this in some kind of loop. And the condition I'm looking for to terminate the loop is just that I got back to the beginning, right? So let's try to write it that way. Say some h prime is equal to h, and then say loop is
should you store the origin?
Say again?
The origin, shouldn't we like store it first when you save half edge in H?
That's what I kind of did here. I called it H, and I'm using H prime here instead of H. So when I'll loop until H prime equals H. Sound great?
What if it's like not a cycle phase?
Right, when it's not connected.
You just like flip over and go back?
No, it's not going to work. So, when you say it's not a cycle, so...
Which is like, if it's
not... Oh, what will happen? Yeah, so you
will flip over. It's not bounded.
Let's see what happens here. So if I ask for, if I give you this space out here, and say this is, let's say that this is F, and this was, well, this is the infinite face. So the infinite face counterclockwise order on the infinite face, again, actually means clockwise. But it's, again, it's following the same convention, right? It's the face on the left-hand side. If this is the half edge associated with F, then what we're going to do is we're going to output... I guess I have to be a little more careful. I guess we should have also stored the edge, if you like. But I'm going to output a collection of half edges. Each half edge has exactly one edge associated with it. There's a couple funny things that happen. First is that if I go around here, first of all, h will be h prime is this, and then h prime is this, and then if it's a leaf like this, the next one is around on the other side. So if you have a node like this, if you read one, then it has this weird property that the half edge here, the next is equal to the twin. On the other side, the twin is equal to the previous. It lists the edges, but it will list this one twice, and you have to decide whether or not that's right or wrong, because in this case, it actually seems to be kind of the right thing, because it tells you exactly what edges you walk around when you walk around this space. There's another reason that this is wrong. It's what I thought you were asking, which is that I say it wrong, I mean, somebody's not complete, because remember that this face, this is actually a list of half edges associated with the face, because it may be that it's not just one connected piece. So really this should be for each h in this list. And that happens when, you, like I said, you have a face where one of them, where one of the faces in the PSLG has a hole in it. So here F is this thing. And so we have to start by walking around one of these faces, and then we walk around the other one. And the orientation that we walk around these, because it's the left-hand side rule, will be opposite. So if the first half edge we see is this one, say this, we will, as we go through this loop, we'll walk around the face, and then we'll finish that loop and go back up here to the next H in next half edge in the list, which might be something like this one. and we'll walk around here, and we'll go through this loop again with the hole. And we'll go through this loop for each hole in the face. So now I'll describe the boundary of the face just by listing all the edges. Yeah.
So do you know that the maximum number of maximum number of half edges we would have would be equal to the dimension?
So the dimension is 2.
Right.
So the number of half edges twice the number of actual edges. And the number of half edges you mean in this list?
Like for, yeah, so the list of half edges that you're holding for the face.
Well, if we assume, for instance, that the all the faces, right, the graph is simple.
Yeah.
Then you could ask how many holes can it have? Well, I guess it doesn't need a hole, right? You're saying you could just have you could have some other degenerate conditions where you have this is the face, and I just have some edges sitting around in here. So it could be that I have a triangle plus a bunch of disjoint edges, and for each edge I need another element in this list. So I guess the answer is n minus, n over 2 minus 2, something like that. You could put an upper bound on it.
Okay.
And I guess you would need to, if you want to give the actual asymptotic running time, but the better way to express that running time would be also not just a function, well, as a function of the size of the output. Because even if I just have one big cycle that has n edges around it, this operation is going to take linear time. Because if the output has linear size, it says list all the edges. So actually, in that case, having this holes doesn't cause such a big problem. You could ask whether or not half storing all this whole list of half edges for a face causes a problem, but I think the answer is still no. I think it's still linear. Because if I have one face with a lot of different holes in here, then I don't have all those holes in any other face. I think you can work it out from where this one goes, that the size will still be linear. So this was the tricky case because faces can have holes in them. The other interesting case, which is actually dual to the case minus the holes, is when we want to take a vertex and report the edges coming out. Particular vertex, and remember for a vertex I can get to some edge coming out of it. Let me draw one. Here's our vertex V, and this is the half edge. I'm writing this as HE. HE is the half edge associated. It's on this side. Now, to go through, there's going to be some other set of edges up here coming out. In order to visit them in counterclockwise order, what I'll do is I'll take the twin to jump to the other side, and then I'll take the next to follow it, and that gives me the next one. And I'm going to repeat this. So the loop is going to look very similar. We're going to say you start with some half edge, the half edge associated with V. You're going to take some h prime, set it equal to h to start. This is how we're remembering where we started. We're going to use it to check out of this loop in the end. And the loop itself will just push these onto the output one at a time. But the update now, instead of taking the next, is going to be next twin. Is that right? Thanks. Right here. And as before, we're going to loop until h equals h prime. Are any of his other operations interesting? We did this one. We did for the faces incident to an edge and the endpoints of an edge. These two operations are also kind of dual to each other. I can write it out, but it's quick to just say it. If I have an edge, then I have some half edge, really. And so there's a face associated with that half edge, and there's a face associated with its twin. Those are the endpoints. Dually, there's an origin associated with that half edge, and there's an origin associated with its twin. Those are the two answers here. So there are some of these kind of degenerate configurations which are worth knowing about if you're going to code one of these up. But for now, we're going to assume that we have nice connected graphs. In fact, maybe we'll assume that they're pretty well connected, and I'll give a definition of what I mean by well connected. Now, first, it's going to look like I'm adding a bunch of definitions just to make our job easier. Like, I'm going to throw up these definitions, and it seems like it just means these definitions are just there to get rid of the bad, ugly cases, the things that are weird, and hanging off, and things that are wrong. And in some sense, that's true. When we restrict the connectivity, we actually get some other interesting structure. And I claim at least that some of this interesting structure is actually interesting, right? For instance, avoiding these like dangling edges really does make sense if, for example, you're looking at a map. Thankfully, no part of the United States is like part of it like one dimensional. There's boundaries, but always any boundaries actually separating things. You can actually characterize the conditions you need to put on a graph to make sure that the drawing actually is reasonable in that sense, in a purely combinatorial condition. So let's say that a graph G E. No, this is just a graph, not a drawing here. We're going to say that graph is K connected. And really, when I say K connected, I mean K vertex connected. If this distinction matters to you, you also sometimes hear this as like K vertex connected. There's also a notion of edge connectivity. We're going to say that G is K connected if G has more than K vertices and G minus X is connected for every subgraph, really every subset of subset X of V such that the size of X is less than or equal to, let's say strictly less than K. So what I mean here, this is, when I say G minus X, this is sometimes called the induced subgraph. I had a graph and I threw out some vertices, right? This is the graph minus some subset of vertices. It's every edge that I can still draw with the vertices that remain. That's the induced subgraph. So if I throw out some vertices, I may also have to throw out the edges, which are incident to that vertex, but I don't throw out anything else. This is the induced subgraph. And if I threw out a set of edges that's smaller than k, it should still be connected. So this is actually not defining, but this is the key property, right? That it's, the graph remains connected even if I throw out some subset of fewer than k. So if I say k equal to 1, this is, with the exception of a graph with just one vertex, this is what we usually mean by a graph being connected. See why that's true.
if, you know, if k equals 1,
yeah,
k equals 1, then it's a, yeah, like, it's just one vertice, right? So
well, it's actually less than, I've removed less than one vertex. So if I, if k equals 1, then it just has to be connected whenever I remove, well, even when I don't remove anything, it should, so it should just be connected, right? So one connected means connected. So maybe not the interesting case. What about two connected?
It's not cyclic.
What's that?
It's not like a, like, it's not a path or a cycle.
It could be a cycle. A cycle is two connected. A path is not two connected. Let's just walk through the definition to be clear. We're saying it has to have at least two vertices, fine. Or it has more than two vertices, so it has at least three vertices, right? But it says that if we remove a subset of less than two vertices, so if I remove a vertex, the graph is still connected. Okay, that's all it says. So two connected means it's still connected even if I remove a vertex. Easy. Three connected. Three connected means it's still connected even if I remove any, maybe two vertices. So I actually have to, if it's three connected, four connected, five connected, there's more and more vertices I have to remove in order to disconnect it. So you can check that a cycle is two connected. There are nice, studied graph theory, there are nice theorems which characterize vertex connectivity of graphs in terms of disjoint paths. So I'll just give you kind of a taste of one of those arguments, just on a cycle. I want to claim that the graph is still connected if I remove any vertex. Well, we know that from any two vertices, A and B, I actually have two completely disjoint paths. I go around the cycle one way or the other way. So if I remove a vertex that's not A and B, then I can only have cut one of those paths, and I still have the other path, so A and B are still connected, and that's true for any pair of vertices. So the cycle is two connected. Like I said, even being one connected is good enough for us to avoid having to deal with some of these issues of holes. I guess this does happen on maps. At lakes and things. Are there any states that are not topologically simple? Michigan is disconnected. What do you think? I'm trying to think of my US geography. Hawaii has many connected components. Any of them have holes in them?
The lake a hole?
I don't think so. I think the state does. Alright. Think about it. These are worthwhile questions. I promise. What we're going to use this for here is that if it's one connected, well then, as we said, that means it's connected. And so there's no holes. If it's two connected, this is also called biconnected. Just something you should realize as an immediate corollary of this definition is that if I am k connected graph, then I'm also k minus 1 connected. Right, it doesn't say anything about it being a maximal k. So three connected graphs are also two. Okay, so one connectivity gets rid of holes, two connectivity gets rid of these kind of dangling edges, or really any situation in which the face of an edge is equal to the face of its twin. Let's check that. So if G is two connected, And I have in a PSLG for G, soil waters, in a planar straight line graph for G, no edge, no half edge, H has property that the face of H is equal to the face of the triangle. Okay, so you can see we're sort of working through these degenerate or kind of tricky cases, and we're just eradicating them with some combinatorial assumption. We're saying, like, well, as long as we're connected enough, a lot of the weird stuff doesn't happen. And so if you happen to have some kind of guarantee like that in whatever object or graph you're trying to represent, you might be able to save yourself some work. Why is this true? I'm going to write this there. Let's always sketch a proof of this.
Well, doesn't that mean that if that's true, then a subset of it would be like a cycle, or like a path? And that'd be a path then?
It doesn't necessarily mean it's a path. Oh, you said it's a subset of something?
A subgraph of it is a path.
Well, every graph has a path that's a subgraph.
Yeah. Like a non, like, three vertices, or sort of four vertices.
Yeah, so if you look at this statement, you start to say, yeah, it's obvious. There's a reason why it starts to feel obvious, and it's the Jordan curve theorem. Did anyone see that we're going to need the Jordan curve theorem for this? That's surprising. Let's, because, you know, what is a face, but it's a connected component of the plane minus the graph, minus the drawing, the image of the embedding of the graph. So let's suppose for contradiction that we have some edge where this is true. How many of us are time? Am I like? Okay. So suppose for contradiction that this is false, and so there exists some H such that the phase of H equals the phase between. Okay, so if this is true, here's H, and I don't know what's over here. There's some part of the graph here, and there's some part of the graph here. But there's something I do know, which is that the face on this side is the face on this side, and the face is a connected component. So it must actually be connected from this side here. It'll loop all the way somewhere. I don't know which way it goes. Somehow it gets around and comes back to here, right? Because this is a this cycle minus, well, this one point on the edge is a path that right, has to be a connected component of the, the faces are connected. That's important. Okay, so if that's true, if they're connected and the path connected, I have a path. I zip that path, the path plus this one point is a simple closed Jordan curve says that. Now I know if I have at least one vertex inside, at least one vertex outside, I know that I won't have any other path that goes from here to here. Right, no edges are going to cross this curve because this curve was drawn in what? In the plane minus the drawing. So since that's the only edge there, then I know if I remove this one vertex, this edge has to go. And that was the only way to get from here to here. So what does that mean? It means I separated the graph. So I removed one vertex and the graph wasn't connected. Therefore, the graph was not too connected. So if I say V equals the origin of H, G minus V is disconnected, right, by the Jordan curve theorem. So G is not too connected. contradiction, so we assume that it was. And so we actually just, you can think of this as a proof by contradiction, or just a direct proof of the contrapositor. Okay. We just supposed that we had such an edge, and we prove that it's not true. Okay, so it means that some of these bad cases are wrong. Another implication of this, which I won't walk through, but I think you will be able to see pretty quickly, is that for two connected graphs, the faces are all simple cycles. And here I'm just using simple cycles, well, cycles in the sense of graphs, so they don't repeat edges. Here, the outer face actually repeated this edge. In this graph, this outer face would repeat this edge once as it goes around this way, once as it goes around this way. We don't get that kind of repetition. We have nice simple cycles, so we can really reason about the faces. There's a theorem that I may prove later in the class when it becomes more relevant, but since it fits so nicely into this sequence, I'll write it down. It's a theorem called Whitney's theorem. Which tells us what happens if we're looking at three connected planar graphs. I guess this, having a PSLG implies that it's planar, but really you should remember that we're talking about planar graphs here. You can't draw it otherwise by the definition of planar graphs. So Whitney's theorem says, this is from way back, I think in the 30s, if G is a simple three connected graph, then faces, and the faces of any two being careful here, so the edges, the lists of edges two drawings of G are the same. So what does that mean? It's saying that if I just abstractly have a graph, let's say I have a graph that looks like this. 1, 2, 3, 4. This is also called K4. You might think of it as the tetrahedron graph. Here's a planar graph. Here's a drawing of it. Here's a different drawing of the same graph. Okay, these are kind of different drawings. Obviously, they're different embeddings. In this case, they're also different. My best effort at planar straight line drawings, the extent to which I can draw straight lines. But there's something that seems majorly different here, which is that here the outer face is 1, 2, 4, and here the outer face is 1, 2, 3. But it's still, I still have this face 1, 2, 4, it's just over here now in this other drawing. Now, the more interesting case maybe is when this graph fails to be three connected, and you can actually get different sets of faces from different drawings. So let me show you how that can happen. Here's a, let's draw a two connected graph that's not three connected. So I can label these vertices. I'm not sure it's useful, but I think we'll do it 7, 8, 9. Okay. This particular drawing of this graph has this face which looks like 1, 2, 7, 8, 5, 4. Both in terms of the vertices, I stated in terms of the edges, but I think you can go back and forth between them. When I drew this last vertex, I could have drawn on the other side. And so there's another drawing of this that's the same everywhere, except I drew 9 over here. And what you'll notice is that face 1, 2, 7, 8, 5, 4 is no longer a face in this other drawing. So, because it was only, but you see how it's only 2 connected here, because if I were to erase vertices 2 and 5, if I were to eliminate these 2, I would have this triangle and the square. It'd be disconnected. This graph is not 3 connected, it's only 2 connected. But since it's not 3 connected, Whitney's theorem doesn't guarantee that the faces are uniquely identified. And in fact, we can see the faces are not unique. Like I have some choice in how I draw it to get different faces depending on where I actually put the vertices. Okay, we're not going to prove this, but it's true. I think later there's a bunch of really nice theorems and algorithms that assume this 3 connectivity, and you can do fun stuff, because what it means really is that now this idea of the face, and this idea of the face came from a real topological notion. It said it was the connected pieces of the plane after you subtract out the drawing. That's that information about what those faces are, or at least how to describe them in terms of edges in the graph, is actually a combinatorial property. It's purely in the graph, as long as the graph is 3 connected. So talking about the faces seem to require us to actually draw it. But if the graph is 3 connected, you can really talk rigorously, correctly, about faces in a 3 connected planar graph, even if you don't draw it. Because no matter how you draw it, you're going to get the same set of faces. It's sort of a beautiful idea. Any questions on that?
This applies only to the 3 connected graph, the theorem.
Yeah, because as you see, even 2 connectivity is not enough. Okay. This is a counterexample for the, if you try to conjecture that 2 connected graphs have unique faces, it's like, no.
Okay.
Questions? Okay, see you next time.